Thank you for being an incredible supporter of the 10X Podcast Group, the home of the skillful art of manipulation. We're thrilled to have you as part of our growing community. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Your likes and comments mean the world to us and help us reach a wider audience with our stories. Plus, with new episodes released every day, your feedback plays a vital role in shaping what we create. It truly makes a difference. Your loyalty and enthusiasm fuel our passion for crafting gripping tales, and we're so grateful for your support. Today, we're excited to present The Fall Guy Protocol, a story that promises to keep you on the edge of your seat. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, Power Play. I never wanted to be a villain. I didn't wake up one day and decide to blackmail cities, cut power to thousands, or mess with the lives of innocent people. It started small, just a test, a harmless experiment, a flex of skill to see if I could do it. The power grid was ancient, running on systems so outdated they should have been in a museum. It was almost too easy. The first time I blacked out a city block, I was 19. Just a cocky kid with a laptop and a grudge against authority. The world didn't make sense back then. It still doesn't. But one thing was clear even in those early days. If you could control the power, you could control everything. Back then, I was hungry, desperate. No money. No future. Just raw talent and the itch to use it. I ran through a dozen usernames before I settled on one. SYNDR. No vowels. Sharp. Clean. It meant nothing. But soon it meant everything. I hacked, I infiltrated, and then I made my first demand. Send me 10 grand, or the lights stay off. And they paid. Just like that. The rush was intoxicating. It wasn't just the money, it was the power. I had entire streets at my mercy, entire neighborhoods plunged into darkness with a few keystrokes. And the best part, they had no idea who I was. No faces, no fingerprints, just a ghost in their systems, pulling the strings. I was untouchable. At least, that's what I thought. The jobs got bigger. The paydays got better. I stopped doing small hits and started working contracts. People like me? We don't work alone. There are others, people who move in the shadows, who see the potential and talent like mine. One of those people was Vance. I've never seen his face. Never heard his real name. All I had was a voice on the other end of a burner phone, smooth and controlled, always three steps ahead. He set up the jobs, I executed them, and the money poured in. It was simple, efficient, clean. Until tonight. The target was a mid-sized city, one I'd worked before. It wasn't supposed to be difficult. Just a temporary blackout. Long enough for a ransom demand to be taken seriously. Standard procedure. The power companies had safety measures in place, hospitals had backup generators, and the worst thing that ever happened was a few grocery stores losing some frozen meat. No big deal. But this time, something went wrong. Horribly wrong. I was sitting in my apartment, staring at my screen, watching the numbers roll in. Another six-figure payday. Easy money. Then my phone buzzed. A news alert. I wasn't prepared for what I saw. Breaking news. Mass casualty incident at City Hospital. Power failure blamed for 20 child deaths in pediatric ICU. I felt it before I understood it. The cold, sinking weight in my gut. I clicked the link, fingers numb. 20 kids. The words blurred. I couldn't breathe. The hospital's generators had failed. They were supposed to be my safety net. A last line of defense. But for some reason, tonight, they hadn't turned on. I leaned forward, scanning the article, searching for something. Anything that made this not my fault. Maybe the hospital had screwed up. Maybe this was some kind of horrible coincidence. But no. Authorities suspect the blackout was an intentional cyberattack, likely tied to an ongoing ransom demand. Police are investigating possible links to known hacking groups. I tasted bile. Vance. There was no way this was an accident. Either he had lied to me, or someone had set me up. I grabbed my burner phone, dialed the number I knew by heart. It rang. Once. Twice. Then click. Vance's voice was smooth as ever. I was wondering when you'd call. You knew, I snarled. You fucking knew what would happen. A pause. Then a chuckle. Does it really matter? I gritted my teeth. My hands were shaking. I wanted to reach through the phone and strangle him. This wasn't the job, I said, trying to keep my voice steady. Hospitals were never part of the deal. Kids weren't part of the deal. Vance sighed, like I was an idiot. You're still thinking small. This was never about money. It was about leverage. I didn't understand. I didn't want to understand. But then he said something that made my blood turn to ice. Every war needs a fall guy. A cold sweat broke out across my skin. I turned back to my screen, hands moving fast. I checked my secure lines, my VPN tunnels, my obfuscation protocols. All of it. I knew my work was clean. I knew there were no leaks. And then I saw it. An alert. A red flashing box in the corner of my screen. Leak detected. My breath caught in my throat. I clicked the link. A forum page loaded. A single post. My name. My face. My fucking home address. Vance's voice hummed in my ear. I'd leave if I were you. The call cut off. My mind blanked. For a few seconds, I didn't move. Didn't breathe. Then I heard it. A noise outside. Distant at first. A low murmur. Then louder. A chant. Burn him. Burn him. I moved to the window. My heart pounded as I pulled back the curtain an inch, just enough to see. A crowd. Dozens of them. Faces twisted in rage. Some held signs with their children's pictures on them. Others had bricks. Bottles. Gasoline. I stumbled back, heart hammering. Then, my phone buzzed again. A text message. Vance, take the blame, or we'll fry your daughter next. I stopped breathing. My throat closed. Emma. My daughter. She had nothing to do with this. Nothing. I called her mother. Voicemail. Again. Again. No answer. I turned back to my screen, mind racing. I wasn't going to take the fall. I wasn't going to be their fucking scapegoat. My fingers flew over the keyboard. I tunneled into the grid, bypassed every firewall, every failsafe. If they wanted to ruin my life, I was taking them with me. I rerouted the power supply. To Vance's neighborhood. I hit execute. The entire district went dark. And outside my apartment, the first window shattered. They were coming for me. Chapter 2, No Way Out. The chants outside swelled like a storm gathering force, a tidal wave of rage about to crash down on me. Burn him. Burn him. Each repetition sent a spike of fear through my veins. It wasn't just noise. It was energy, raw and violent, pulsing through the mob like an electrical current. They weren't just angry. They were ready. Ready to tear me apart. I backed away from the window, heart slamming against my ribs. My hands shook as I reached for my phone, staring at the message again. Vance, take the blame, or we'll fry your daughter next. My stomach lurched. Emma. 7 years old. Her biggest worry should have been bedtime, not this. Not being dragged into a nightmare her father created. I dialed her mother's number again. Straight to voicemail. No. No, no, no. I tried again. Nothing. I clenched my teeth. My jaw ached from how hard I was grinding it. My mind raced, flipping through every possibility. Had Vance already made his move? Had he sent someone to her house? Would she even know to run? A crash snapped my attention back to the present. Glass shattered. I turned. The front window was caving in, spiderwebbed with cracks from a thrown rock. The second projectile followed immediately, a brick this time. It hit the glass and punched through. Shards exploded into my living room, raining down over my desk, my keyboard, my half-drunk coffee. I could hear them now. Footsteps. Multiple. They weren't just outside anymore. They were moving around the house, testing the doors, trying the locks. My breathing quickened. This was it. They were coming in. I bolted for my bedroom, yanking open a drawer and grabbing my pistol. My fingers were slick with sweat as I checked the magazine. Fully loaded. Safety off. I wasn't planning to use it. But I wasn't planning to die either. I grabbed my backpack, dumped in my laptop, my external drive, burner phones, anything I could carry that mattered. I didn't have time to wipe my system. Didn't have time to cover my tracks. I needed out. I cracked the back door open an inch and peered out. More of them. Three men, standing near the fence, backs turned. Shit. The front was blocked. The back was blocked. The only way out was through. I swallowed, steeling myself. Move fast. Move quiet. Don't stop. I pushed the door open. Stepped out. The second my foot hit the ground, a voice barked. Hey. I didn't hesitate. I took off. Shouts erupted behind me. He's running. Get him. I tore across the yard, my lungs burning, feet barely touching the ground. I vaulted the fence just as hands grabbed at my shirt. My sleeve ripped, but I was free, hitting the ground hard on the other side. I rolled and scrambled up, sprinting down the alley. Footsteps thundered behind me. I didn't look back. I knew what I'd see. A pack of people fueled by rage and grief, hunting me like an animal. They wanted justice. I understood that. Hell, I wanted justice. But not for me. For the kids. I wasn't the one who made the call. I wasn't the one who let the generators fail. I wasn't the one who watched the life drain from those little bodies and thought, eh, collateral damage. But in their eyes, I was the villain. And villains don't get a fair trial. Villains get punished. I made it 3 blocks before I had to stop. My lungs felt like they were about to burst. I ducked into a narrow gap between 2 buildings, pressing myself against the cold brick. Breathe. Slow. In. Out. I listened. The mob was still looking. I could hear them. Find him. He couldn't have gone far. They were spreading out. Searching. I wiped the sweat from my face, forcing my mind to focus. Think. Plan. Act. I needed a car. A weapon. A way to get to Vance before he got to Emma. I checked my burner phone. No signal. They'd cut my comms. Vance had thought of everything. Except for one thing. I was still alive. And that was his mistake. I slipped through the alley, keeping low, moving fast. I needed wheels, and I needed them now. Luck, for once, was on my side. A sedan sat parked near the curb, engine running, exhaust curling into the night air. I scanned the area, no driver in sight. Maybe they'd left it running while grabbing something inside. Didn't matter. I sprinted up, yanked the door open, and slid behind the wheel. Hey! A voice. Someone had seen me. No time. I slammed the car into drive and floored it. Tires screeched. The engine roared. A man dove out of the way as I fishtailed onto the main road. Behind me? Shouts. Screams. More chaos. I didn't care. I had one focus now. Get to Emma. I drove like a demon, cutting through the city, running every red light. Sirens blared in the distance, but they weren't for me. Not yet. My mind raced as fast as the car. Vance wasn't just some middleman. He was bigger than I thought. More connected. He had resources. He had reach. And if he had Emma. I clenched the wheel, my knuckles turning white. No. I couldn't think like that. Not yet. I forced my breathing to slow. If I lost control now, I was dead before I even reached her. I needed a plan. I still had access to the grid. And if Vance wanted to play God, I was about to show him what happens when the devil fights back. I checked the clock. 3:47 a.m. By sunrise, I was going to burn his entire world down. Chapter 3, The Kill Order. There's a moment when fear stops being fear and turns into something else. Something sharper. Colder. It's the moment when you realize that survival isn't about running anymore. It's about fighting. I had hit that moment. Emma was out there, and Vance had her. I didn't have time to be afraid. The city blurred past as I drove, streetlights streaking against the windshield. I didn't have an exact address for Vance, but I knew the district. Knew the type of place a man like him would hide. Rich. Gated. Private security. The kind of neighborhood that made its own rules. I wasn't getting in through the front gate. But that was fine. I didn't need the gate. I had something better. The power grid. My fingers tapped against the steering wheel, my brain running scenarios. My laptop was still in my bag, but hacking from a moving car wasn't an option. I needed a place to stop. Somewhere safe. Somewhere I wouldn't be found. My old hideout. It wasn't much, a shitty one-room studio above a closed-down laundromat. Barely any furniture. No working stove. Just a mattress on the floor and a desk with an extra monitor. But the internet was fast, and the walls were thick. I pulled into the alley behind the building and killed the engine. The second I stepped out of the car, paranoia kicked in. Eyes. I felt them. Watching. I scanned the shadows. The rooftops. Nothing. No movement. But that didn't mean I wasn't being tracked. I hurried up the rusted fire escape and slipped inside. Locked the door behind me. My hands moved fast. Laptop open. System booting. Let's see what you're hiding, Vance. I cracked into the city's security grid first, pulling up traffic cams, street feeds, anything that might show me where he was moving. The gated community was blacked out. Just like I planned. No cameras. No signals. But I didn't need eyes. I had the power logs. And one house had just flipped its backup generators twice in the last hour. Bingo. I zoomed in on the address. High walls. Big property. A fucking mansion. Emma was in there. And I was going to get her out. I moved fast. Laptop in my bag. Gun in my waistband. I knew I couldn't storm the place. That was suicide. Vance had security. Cameras. Guards. the kind of people who shot first and never asked questions. But I had one advantage: the darkness. I could keep his house blacked out for as long as I wanted. No cameras. No alarms. Just silence. And in the silence, people get sloppy. The drive to Vance's estate was tense. I took back roads, doubled back twice, kept checking my rearview mirror. No tails. Either Vance was confident I'd die before reaching him, or he was watching from a distance, waiting to see how far I'd go. Either way, I was going to surprise him. I parked 3 blocks away, stashed the car, and moved on foot. My heart pounded against my ribs as I approached the neighborhood. The blackout had done its job. The entire block was dark. Vance's mansion loomed at the top of the hill, surrounded by a 12-foot stone wall. The only light came from the inside, where a few candles flickered behind the windows. That meant someone was still awake. And that someone could be Emma. I crept through the trees, my footsteps silent on the damp grass. My pulse was a drum in my ears. Closer. Closer. I reached the perimeter wall and pressed myself against the stone. Listened. 2 voices. Men. Guarding the entrance. Armed. I needed a distraction. I pulled out my phone, connected to the hacked grid, and triggered every car alarm on the block. The noise was instant. A chain reaction of blaring sirens, flashing lights, chaos. The guards swore, turning towards the street. I moved. Quick. Silent. Over the wall in seconds. I hit the ground on the other side and rolled. No alarms. No gunfire. So far, so good. The back door was locked. No surprise. But the kitchen window? That was open. I slid inside, careful not to make a sound. The air was thick with cigar smoke and expensive cologne. I gripped my gun tighter and moved deeper into the house. The place was huge, dimly lit by candles. Marble floors. Floor-to-ceiling windows. I crept down a hallway, my ears straining for any sound. Then I heard it. A muffled cry. Small. Weak. Emma. I followed the sound upstairs. Second door on the right. Locked. I pressed my ear against the wood. Soft sniffles. She was in there. I forced my breathing to slow. I could break the door down, but that would alert every guard in the house. I needed to be smarter. I took a step back, raised my gun, and fired through the lock. The door swung open. Emma gasped, eyes wide with terror. She was tied to a chair. Tears streaked her face. Her wrists were red from struggling. She looked at me like she didn't recognize me. Like she was afraid of me. Emma, I whispered, moving forward, kneeling in front of her. It's me, baby. It's Dad. She hiccuped a sob. Daddy. I nodded, heartbreaking. I'm here. I'm gonna get you out, okay? I reached for the ropes. Started untying her. Then, a voice behind me. Touch her again, and I blow your fucking head off. I turned slow. Vance stood in the doorway. Gun in hand. A smirk on his face. I kept my expression blank, but inside my blood was boiling. You really don't get it, do you? Vance sighed, shaking his head. You think this is about revenge? About making you pay? I didn't respond. I just stared at him. Waiting. He exhaled smoke. Smiled. It's about control. And then he pulled out his phone. Showed me the screen. A kill order. My name. A bounty. $5 million. Posted. Public. Open contract. A death sentence. I barely had time to react before my own phone buzzed. I glanced at it. A text. Unknown run. And then, a gunshot. Chapter 4, Cutting the Power. The gunshot tore through the air like a crack of thunder. I moved on instinct. Dove. A second shot followed, ripping through the space where my head had been a second ago. The bullet punched into the wall, splintering wood. Emma screamed, high and sharp, the kind of scream that twists a father's soul into knots. Vance was still in the doorway, gun aimed. I hit the ground hard, rolled behind the bed, my gun already up, my hand steady despite the chaos pounding in my chest. I fired twice. First shot, wide. Second, closer. Vance ducked back into the hallway, avoiding both, but I heard his hiss of pain. A graze, maybe. Then the footsteps. Heavy. Fast. Multiple. His guards were coming. Shit. Daddy. Emma sobbed. Daddy, please. I crawled to her, keeping low. My hands worked fast, pulling at the last of the knots. I got you, baby, I whispered, voice hoarse. I got you. But you have to hold on tight, okay? She nodded fast, eyes wide and terrified. I scooped her up, cradling her against me. She felt so small. So fragile. But I couldn't let that break me. I had one job now. Get her out. I moved toward the window. My mind was already calculating. Second floor. 15 feet down. Not a safe jump, but safer than staying here. I threw the window open. Cold night air blasted in. The backyard stretched below. Pool, patio, thick hedges. I grabbed a curtain, ripped it from the rod. Tied one end to the radiator, the other around Emma. Slide down, I whispered, trying to keep my voice calm. Hold tight, don't look back. She was crying, but she listened. She clutched the fabric and started sliding. I didn't wait to see if she made it safely. The door exploded open behind me. I twisted, just in time to see a man in tactical gear storm in. I fired first, point blank. The bullet caught him in the chest. Vest stopped it, but the impact sent him stumbling. I lunged forward, gun up, two more shots, head and throat. He went down, shouting, more boots thundering down the hallway. I grabbed the dead man's rifle, slung it over my shoulder, then jumped. The fall was hard. The grass broke my landing, but I still hit wrong, ankle twisted, pain flaring up my leg. Didn't matter. Emma was on the patio, eyes wet, shaking. I pulled her close. We have to run. I expected her to argue, to break down. She didn't. She nodded. That's my girl. I grabbed her hand and sprinted toward the trees. The back fence was high, but climbable. I boosted Emma first, whispering, hold on, don't let go. She struggled, but made it over. I jumped after her, just as more gunfire erupted. Bullets chewed the ground behind us. Vance wasn't playing anymore. He wanted me dead. I grabbed Emma's hand and kept running. We ran for two blocks before I spotted a car, a sedan idling by the curb, engine running, unattended. I didn't hesitate. Yanked the door open. Shoved Emma inside. Slid behind the wheel. A voice shouted behind me. Hey! I didn't listen. I floored it. Tires screeched, and we tore off into the night. I drove fast. Backroads, side streets, cutting through alleys to lose any tail. My hands ached from gripping the wheel too hard. Emma was curled in the seat beside me, small hands clutching the seatbelt. She was still crying, but silent now. Shock setting in. I reached out, squeezed her fingers. She flinched, but didn't pull away. I exhaled slow. We're safe, I said. Lied. I promise. She just nodded, eyes glassy. I forced my mind to focus. We weren't safe. Not yet. Vance wouldn't stop. Not until I was dead. Not until Emma was gone. There was only one way to end this. I needed to disappear. My old hideout wasn't safe anymore. My name was out there. That kill order was real. $5 million. Every assassin, hacker, and bounty hunter on the planet would be gunning for me. I had one move left. I pulled off the highway and parked in an abandoned lot. Emma was half asleep, exhaustion pulling her under. I gently shook her. Baby, we have to switch cars. She whimpered but nodded. We ditched the stolen sedan and found a beat-up old pickup behind a shuttered gas station. I hotwired it in seconds. Emma climbed in beside me, trusting me. She shouldn't. But she did. I needed a plan. I had one ace left. The power grid. Vance thought he was untouchable? Thought his wealth, his security, his connections made him God? I was about to rip that illusion apart. I pulled out my laptop, tethered to a stolen hotspot. Logged in. My heart pounded. I dove deep into the grid. Every bank account tied to Vance? I froze them. Every property in his name? I flagged them for federal investigation. His electricity? His gas? His security systems? I shut them all down. Then I did one final thing. I accessed his personal files. Dumped everything online. His crimes. His operations. His contacts. I burned his world in real time. And the last thing I did, I sent him a message. A simple, single line. Checkmate. Then I shut the laptop. Turned to Emma. Brushed her hair back. She was looking at me with wide, innocent eyes. Where are we going, Daddy? She whispered. I exhaled, started the truck, and drove into the darkness. Chapter 5, The Setup. The road stretched ahead, endless and dark, disappearing into nothing. A black ribbon slicing through the dead hours of the night. The truck's engine hummed, steady, a low vibration through the steering wheel. My hands were tight on the leather, knuckles white. Not from fear. Not anymore. I wasn't scared. I was pissed. Vance had crossed the line. He hadn't just come for me. He had come for my daughter. I couldn't let that stand. Emma sat curled in the passenger seat, knees tucked to her chest, staring out the window with glassy eyes. The exhaustion had settled deep in her bones. the weight of fear, of running, of being yanked from her bed and thrown into a nightmare. She didn't speak. She didn't need to. I reached out, touched her shoulder. "You okay, baby?" She flinched at first. Then slowly she nodded. I lied to her again. "We're gonna be okay." Another nod. She didn't believe me. I didn't either. I drove fast. Kept the lights low. Stuck to back roads. The city faded behind us, swallowed by distance, by the weight of what I had just done. I had burned Vance's world. His money? Gone. His operations? Exposed. His power? Dwindling by the second. And the best part? I wasn't finished. The kill order was still out there. $5 million on my head. Which meant I had two choices. Run. Hide. Live the rest of my life looking over my shoulder, waiting for the next bullet, the next shadow in the dark. End this. I wasn't good at running. But I was very good at making sure people never got back up again. I pulled the truck into an empty parking lot behind a rundown diner. Dim lights flickered overhead, buzzing against the quiet. Emma was asleep now, breathing slow, body slack. I let her rest. I stepped out, stretched my legs, pulled my laptop from the back seat. Time for phase two. I cracked my knuckles, exhaled slow, and went to work. First move, surveillance. Vance was a control freak. He wouldn't sit back and let me tear his empire apart without trying to stop me. He was going to move. I needed to know where. I tapped into the city's traffic feeds, the cellular grid, the emergency channels. Dug deep, bypassed layers of security designed to keep people like me out. I wasn't just looking for Vance. I was looking for his mistakes. His patterns. His movements. I found them. A car. An unregistered black SUV, weaving through the streets way too fast. Headed toward a private airstrip. That was him. He was running. Coward. I leaned back in the seat, tapped my fingers against the keyboard. "You're not getting away that easy, motherfucker," I muttered. I ran his flight records. Nothing under his name. Of course. He was too smart for that. But I was smarter. I cross-checked every chartered flight in the last hour, looking for anomalies. And there it was. A private jet, scheduled for wheels up in 30 minutes. Destination? Unknown. But I knew. He was disappearing. Going dark. Changing his name, his face, his entire fucking life. I couldn't let that happen. I pulled my phone. Dialed a number I hadn't called in years. It rang. Once. Twice. Then. A voice. Low. Gruff. Amused. "Well, well. Thought you were dead." I exhaled. "Not yet." A chuckle. "Need something. Big." Silence. Then. "Tell me." I told him. Everything. The setup. The kill order. Vance. The jet. My friend, my old friend, listened. Took it all in. Then he sighed. "You're in deep shit, brother." "I know." Another pause. Then. "I can help. But you owe me." I already owed him. A long time ago, he pulled me out of a hole even deeper than this one. I nodded. "I know." He chuckled again. "All right. Sit tight. I'll send a little surprise to the airstrip." He hung up. I put the phone down, exhaled slow. Then I turned to my laptop. I wasn't done yet. Final step, cutting the power. Vance had one last play. That jet. If it took off, I might never find him again. So I made sure it never got off the ground. I pulled up the airport grid. The power supply. The fuel systems. The communications network. And I did what I did best. I shut it all down. I stared at the screen, heart pounding. Then a text. "Unknown, nice move. He's grounded. But he's not dead." I frowned. Typed back. "Me, he will be." A pause. Then. "Unknown, good. I'll see you soon." I stared at the screen for a long time. Something was wrong. That wasn't my friend. I had just stepped into another game. And I had no idea who was playing. Chapter 6. The truth comes out. When analyzing the sequence of events up to this moment, one must recognize that Vance's actions were not just reactive measures against a perceived threat. They were preemptive strikes within a calculated framework of manipulation. Every decision he made, from leaking my address to initiating the kill order, was not merely a response to my defiance, but a strategic move to shift the balance of power in his favor. The revelations began to emerge as I examined the pattern of his behavior. First, there was the timeline of his financial transactions. Cross-referencing his accounts revealed a consistent pattern. Substantial withdrawals in the days leading up to major cyber operations. These funds were transferred to shell companies, offshore accounts, and aliases, all of which suggested a broader network at play. In essence, Vance's financial activities were not random, but instead aligned with the operational needs of a coordinated effort to maintain dominance and control. Additionally, his communications history provided critical insights. The encrypted messages, intercepted and decrypted through my efforts, showed a clear chain of command. Vance was not working in isolation. He was a node within a larger web of influence. His correspondences referenced higher-ranking figures, individuals who issued directives and approved strategies. This indicated that Vance was not the ultimate decision-maker, but a well-placed lieutenant who executed orders from above. By examining the structure of these exchanges, it became evident that Vance's primary function was to manage logistics, maintain plausible deniability for his superiors, and eliminate liabilities when necessary. The most compelling evidence of Vance's role within this hierarchy came from his own words. During the confrontation, his demeanor shifted from arrogance to something more calculated. His statement, "This was never just about the blackout," carried implications far beyond the immediate situation. It suggested that the hospital incident, which resulted in tragic casualties, was not an unforeseen consequence, but a deliberately chosen pressure point. This choice was meant to create chaos, discredit me, and ensure that any resistance I offered would be met with overwhelming public outrage. From a tactical perspective, this was not just a means of eliminating a rival. It was a method of consolidating control by turning public opinion against a common enemy, thereby obscuring the true perpetrators. Moreover, the nature of the kill order itself revealed a significant shift in strategy. Typically, a bounty of such magnitude, $5 million, would be issued quietly through underground channels. But this kill order was made public, leaked in a manner that guaranteed maximum visibility. The analytical conclusion was clear. This was not just an attempt to neutralize me. It was an attempt to make a statement. By placing a massive bounty on my head, Vance's organization sent a clear message to anyone else who might consider opposing them. It was a show of strength, intended to deter future challenges and reaffirm their dominance. In evaluating these elements, it became apparent that Vance's behavior was not driven by personal vendetta or spontaneous reaction. Instead, his actions were part of a meticulously planned operation. The hospital blackout, the leaked address, the kill order, each step served a dual purpose, removing a threat and reinforcing the organization's authority. Vance's true allegiance was not to his own survival, but to the preservation of the network's power structure. This realization carried profound implications. It meant that taking down Vance was not the endgame. It was merely the first step in dismantling a much larger operation. If Vance was a pawn, then the real players were still out there, pulling the strings. And if I wanted to end this once and for all, I would need to shift my approach, from targeting Vance to uncovering the identities of those who stood above him. In conclusion, the evidence pointed to a single, inescapable truth. Vance was a well-placed operative within a broader system of control and coercion. His actions, while harmful on a personal level, were strategically designed to maintain his organization's dominance. Understanding this allowed me to reframe the conflict not as a simple struggle against one man, but as a calculated effort to expose and dismantle the machinery that had made him untouchable. By analyzing his financial transactions, communications, and public statements, it became clear that Vance was never the real enemy. He was the tip of the iceberg, and the true threat remained hidden beneath the surface. Chapter 7, The Final Move. In considering the events leading to the conclusion, it becomes clear that the choices made in these final moments are not only about personal survival, but about redefining the power dynamics that have persisted throughout the narrative. The circumstances at hand required a decisive, calculated response. One that would dismantle the remaining infrastructure supporting Vance's network and render any retaliation futile. This was no longer about simply escaping or protecting Emma. It was about taking control of the narrative and ensuring that this network could no longer wield its influence unchecked. The first aspect of the resolution hinged on strategic misdirection. Vance and his superiors had operated on the assumption that my next move would be purely reactive, a desperate attempt to flee, or an ill-conceived act of direct confrontation. To exploit this expectation, I initiated a series of false signals. By deliberately leaving digital breadcrumbs pointing to an overseas escape route, I created the impression that I was abandoning the fight altogether. This misdirection was not just about buying time. It was about pulling their focus away from my actual objective. In any high-stakes operation, controlling the flow of information is paramount, and by feeding them misinformation, I effectively controlled their response. Simultaneously, I re-established access to the critical nodes within their infrastructure. The previous chapters had revealed the fragility of their systems. Despite their outward appearance of security, they were vulnerable at key junctures. I identified these points of weakness, such as secondary communication channels and hidden financial reserves, and targeted them methodically. By using the very access they had unwittingly provided, I began to strip away their resources. It was not enough to simply disrupt their operations. I needed to leave them with no means to recover. Each system I took down, each account I froze, each server I disabled, eroded their ability to retaliate or regroup. Another critical element involved exposing the network's hidden players. Vance's previous admissions and the digital correspondence I had decrypted contained references to individuals who remained in the shadows, issuing directives and profiting from the chaos. These figures had built their influence on anonymity and the fear of exposure. By publishing detailed records of their activities, transactions, encrypted communications, and meeting logs, I transformed their anonymity into liability. The public dissemination of this information was not just a tactic of revenge. It was a strategic maneuver to remove their shield of secrecy. The analytical outcome of this exposure was twofold. It forced these individuals into hiding, thus neutralizing their influence, and it rallied external forces, law enforcement, independent investigators, and other adversaries against them. The final confrontation with Vance was not a moment of dramatic violence or a single climactic showdown. Instead, it was the inevitable collapse of his position within the larger network. As his resources vanished, his allies abandoned him, and his secrets became public knowledge, Vance's power diminished to the point of irrelevance. This shift in power was not achieved through direct combat, but through the meticulous application of pressure on all fronts. He was no longer the mastermind holding all the cards. He became just another exposed operative with nowhere to turn. In the end, the resolution was not about vengeance or personal triumph. It was about permanently altering the structure that had allowed Vance and his superiors to thrive. By dismantling the network's resources, exposing its hidden players, and controlling the flow of information, I ensured that this system of manipulation and coercion could no longer function. This analytical approach, rooted in strategy, timing, and precision, allowed me not only to survive, but to bring an end to the network's reign. In conclusion, the final move was not a singular act of bravery or violence, but a carefully orchestrated series of maneuvers designed to dismantle the network at its core. By leveraging misdirection, targeting structural weaknesses, and exposing key players, the outcome was not just the neutralization of an immediate threat, but the long-term disruption of an entire power structure. This was the true resolution, a conclusion that rendered the network powerless and ensured that the events that had unfolded would not repeat themselves.